Hi everyone, welcome to Corporate Chat Podcast. Your hosts for today are Loic Meunier and myself, Mathis Grandchamp. We're both pursuing a bachelor's degree in finance at McGill University. Thank you to our sponsors, Deloitte, Samantha of Development LTD, and Red Bull. Dr. Forestier teaches at HEC Paris, ESSEC Business School, École Polytechnique, and co-founded EvalXP, a company helping small-cap and lower-mid-cap companies with valuation and structuring issues. Mr. Forestier provides valuable insights and perspectives in the world of private equity from his teaching experience in corporate finance. Mr. Forestier has a bachelor's degree in engineering from Grenoble University, a master's degree in optoelectronic and radio frequency also from Grenoble University, a PhD from École Polytechnique in high-power ultra-fast laser for military and industrial applications, and after 4 years working at Airbus as a researcher after obtaining his PhD, he pursued a master's degree at HEC Paris in financial management. Without further ado, here's our conversation with Dr. Benjamin Forestier. Hi, Mr. Forestier. How are you doing today?
Yeah, fine. Thank you.
I'd love to hear about your background and history on how you ended up where you are today.
Sure. So I will explain. To be honest, the path is quite unusual, I have to say. So clearly it would be a long story short, because otherwise I couldn't tell for a full hour, you know. So very quickly. So in fact, I'm not a finance guy, basically. At the beginning, I was a scientist, a physicist, in fact. So 20 years ago, I did an engineer school in France. So Institut National Polytechnique de Grenoble, and nothing related in finance. It was an engineer school specialized in quantum mechanics and optoelectronics. So basically, at this time, I even wasn't able to read an income statement, really. Then I made a PhD in physics at École Polytechnique. And so here I have to say it was really, really high-level physics. So I made a lot, I have to say, of stochastic calculus, partial differential equation, and so on. And so basically, this is the kind of math, in fact, you can find in plasma physics, linear optics, and so on, but also in market finance, in fact. So probably you have some classes about option pricing and so on, derivatives. In fact, the equations are the same, you know? So basically, you take the heat equation in physics and the Black-Scholes equation, basically, they are the same, you know? Yeah. And so, you know, I was a researcher. And in fact, I saw my colleague working in finance, in market finance, doing the same job as me, but for maybe 4 times the wages, you know?
So, yeah.
Honestly. And so I was telling to myself, but what the crap, you know? So basically, I said, okay, I should switch to market finance. But in fact, it was very, very hard for two reasons. First, because in fact, at this time, I didn't have any degree in finance, in fact. And so basically, to set yourself in the bank, good luck, you know? So it's very competitive, even when you have a master in finance and so on. So with a PhD in physics, good luck, you know. And the second stuff, in fact, it was the timing. It was during the financial crisis, you know. So basically, it was more, I would say, about layoff in banks instead of hiring, you know. And so in fact, I started basically doing research, in fact, in quantitative finance. And, you know, this is very important. I have reached several quants and some very well-known quants, proposing, in fact, to work for them for free, in fact, just to gain experience. And so, honestly, I had a huge luck that someone accepted, and this guy was Peter Carr. I don't know if you know Peter Carr in quantitative finance. So he was at this time head of research at Morgan Stanley in New York. And it was also professor at Courant University in New York. No. Very top quant. And so in fact, we publish paper together and so on. And I believe that this time, it would be enough to get a job as a quant. And in fact, no. So unfortunately, I had to return to the industry. So to return in engineering in physics, in fact. And so I returned this time at Airbus. So not in the plane part, but in the military side, you know. Okay. And so at this time, you know, I was really interested into strategy, organization, and so on. And so basically, I have to say, in quantitative finance, you have nothing about that. Quantitative finance, it's only pure math, pure statistics. So really, when you price, for example, a Tesla option, you don't give a shit about the strategy of Elon Musk. Yeah. It's just a mathematical model about projecting the statistics, you know? No more, no less. And so I said to myself, yeah, clearly, I want to understand the link between the strategy organization and the financial performance of a firm. And so, in fact, I restarted my studies, in fact. And so I was 30 years old at this time. Yeah. And so I did an MBA at HEC Paris, specialty investment banking. And so clearly, it was very, very fun because I was the youngest of the promotion, you know, and I was the only one without any corporate finance background. So all my colleagues, they were CFOs and so on. But basically, you know, I will tell you something, and nothing pejorative. It's corporate finance compared to physics and maths. It's simple. It's very, very simple. So basically, I managed to grasp the concept very, very quickly. And so at the end of the MBA, a professor at HEC Paris proposed me to become a teacher, in fact, at HEC Paris. So obviously not a full-time professor, but something like a teaching assistant, you know, so to teach some class. Okay? And so it was really the beginning of a kind of parallel life, you know. And why? Because from one side, I was still working in research and development at Airbus, and it was part-time. And one day a week, I was teaching finance. Okay? And so I did that, but for maybe, 7 or 8 years. And so clearly, I have to say, I decided to leave Airbus, in fact, for several reasons. First, because I claimed the leader, and at the end, I was the head of strategy of a subsidiary of Airbus. And so clearly, in terms of organization, it was very hard, in fact. So I had to focus on one thing, you know. And so clearly, I decided to focus on finance. And so, in fact, nowadays, I have two activities, teaching and training. And so I teach at École Polytechnique, for example. And I'm very proud of that because I teach finance in engineer school. And by the way, this is the school where I did my PhD, in fact, but my PhD in physics. So my colleague at the Department of Economics, they made a lot of fun of me, you know. But at least, okay. And also, I teach at other business schools, for example, HEC Paris, STIHL, and ESSEC also. And training. Because in fact, you will be surprised, but a lot of senior bankers, after maybe 10 years of professional experience, but they forget, in fact, the basic stuff, in fact. Because you are really focused on the day-to-day operation, you're really focused on the management side of your job and so on. And so basically, when you ask to someone to compute a work or something like that, you have no answer, you know? And so basically, I have also a training activity to senior banker, okay? And then I have funded, so now 5 years ago, a small consulting shop. And by the way, my partner is the professor I had at HEC Paris, in fact. So really, it's really a long story, you know? And so basically, this is a very small boutique and we focus about two things, a lot about valuation. So for example, you have the CEO of a small cap who wants to know before selling his business, what would be the range of price, you know, basically. And also second step about structuring. For example, I want to make this acquisition. So, you know, I have my user fund, you know, basically, how should I structure the deal? You know, for example, what is the level of debt? What is the level of equity and so on? Okay. So I did really the shortest, the shortest possible for me, you know?
Yeah. So thanks, Benjamin, for that. You mentioned working in a lot of different fields on the quantitative side of finance as a teacher on the corporate side. Can you tell us a little bit how you founded your company and what opportunity came across at that time?
Yeah, sure. So clearly, in fact, I have founded my company for a very simple reason. And I think you would be interested into that. First, I wanted to work in investment banking, but without the time pressure of investment banking. So basically, you know, I have a lot of students working in very big IBs. So clearly, Goldman, Morgan Stanley, for example, in London, I have a lot of students there, and Rothschild and Lazard in Paris, for example. Clearly, long story short, they have no free time. No free time, really. And the pressure is very, very high. And so, by the way, a lot of those students, after 2, 3, 4 years, they leave the bank. Okay? In my case, I say, hey, you know, I already had a lot of pressure on Airbus and so on. I want to be my own boss, you know? And so, okay, obviously, so I am 40 years old now. 40 years old in investment banking, you are managing director, even partner. So believe me, you are very wealthy. I don't have this kind of money, but at least I have more free time. And also something which is very important, it's when you have your own boutique, you choose your client. So you choose the deal, you will work on it, you know? And so for example, I'm very interested into industrial stuff and so on. So I have made a lot of deals about that. And at contrario, for example, I don't have a lot of feelings about healthcare, for example. I know nothing about this sector and I'm not interested in it, you know. But when you are in an IB, you have no choice. You are an analyst or associate or even a VP, you don't choose the deal you will work on, you know. So here, my focus basically is, as I said, small to lower mid cap. So basically, in order to give a range, firms with EBITDA between 1 million to, let's say, 50 million, you know, 1 to 50 million EBITDA. I have also in the past made several valuation missions for startups, you know, for fundraising and so on. But those are very, very specific mission. Because as you know, the valuation of a startup, it's more like that. Huh?
Right. And now moving on to the market segment.
Yeah.
You teach classes on private equity and investment banking. How would you approach private investments in the current rate environment, you know, when rates are high but expected to decrease in the upcoming months or year, especially in private equity allocations where debt financing plays a crucial role?
Yeah. So here, for me, before answering your question, two stuff. Distinguishing investment banking and private equity. You know, when you work in investment banking, so basically in M&A, you are a deal machine. So what does it mean? Your job is to make transactions. So, and obviously, every banker want to be sell side. And for several reasons. First, because in fact, it's easier to sell a business than to buy one. And second, because it's much more lucrative in terms of fees. So you have a success fees in sell side, you don't have in buy side. Last year, it was a very bad year in France for M&A. Very, very bad one. And bad one, especially on one segment, large cap. The small cap segment, I have to say, was less affected than the large cap one. Honestly, last year, I think that there was not a single large cap deal in France. And for a simple reason, it's because as a buyer, you are not able anymore to get the financing, in fact. Because something important, the interest rate increased. Okay. But in fact, this is not the main effect. The main effect that the bank reduced their lending capacity, in fact. For example, to be concrete, in the small cap, for example, a few years ago, you can borrow up to 5 to 6 times EBITDA, for example, for LBO. Now it's 3-4, you know. So they reduce the leverage. And so basically, the real problem is that normally, you know, normally you are good in finance, the leverage decreases, the interest rate increases, the valuation should decrease. But the problem is that the seller, they don't want to sell anymore, in fact. And because, in fact, two or three years ago, they saw that their business was worth 12 times EBITDA. And now you are saying 9. The guy say no. Eh? He say, sorry, at 9, I won't sell it anymore, in fact. So the real problem is that. But basically, you know, as a seller, from time to time, you have to sell. Otherwise, no cash. And so basically, 2022, 2023, it was a very quiet M&A period. But a lot of people expect a rebound this year, in fact, for two reasons. First, for the selling pressure, as I said, because you have your business, you want to sell it, and so you have to sell it in order to have the cash. And also because, as you said, the market price decreases interest rate. So both in USA and Europe, by the way. The real problem, it's when. And here, good luck. Yeah, if you want to forecast when. Okay, so for a PE fund, what did it change? So basically, they have to focus more on what is called value creation. Because basically, in the past years, you had a strong effect known as multiple expansion. I don't know if you know what is multiple expansion. For example, I buy this firm 8 times EBITDA, and I sell it 11 times EBITDA by doing basically nothing. And why? Because in fact, the interest rates were so low that in fact, the multiple every year they increased. If you look at the valuation multiple in USA or in France, for 10 years, before the COVID and so on, every year it increased. So basically, the life was good. Okay. Now it's really different. You have to create value. What does it mean? It means that you have to improve the top line of the business. You have to improve the margins. You have to improve the cash conversion. You have to make strategic acquisitions. So basically, I mean, for me, it's very good because it means that as a PFL manager, you have to do your job, in fact. So, in my opinion, you know, for me, this environment is more an opportunity than a crisis, in fact, honestly. And so in terms of allocation, to focus on your question, yeah, the main problem of private equity nowadays is private debt. And why? Because remember, you are an LP. So LP is someone giving money to a fund. You have the choice between several asset classes. Okay? And you have private equity. Net internal rate of return in average 15%. You know, the IRR, you know, 15%. Private debt nowadays, 15%, almost the same. But by the way, with a risk which is much lower. Because here, it's a debt, it's not equity, you know. Okay? And also, even if you are a private capital fund manager, private debt is easier. Because in fact, you just put your ticket, so you lend the money to the firm, and then it's like that, you know. You don't have to run the business, you know, compared to private equity. And so that's why I'm not surprised that you have a lot of PE firms transitioning to private debt. Okay? Something which is very important, and that, believe me, they will discover it. Private debt, it's much closer to equity than to bank debt. Because in fact, you have no security, and it's very junior, in fact. So in case of default, the recovery is very, very low. So basically, maybe in a few years, we will see that some people lend money a bit too easy, you know? Okay?
Yeah, thank you. And can you talk about the differences in private equity in France as opposed to the US?
Clearly, for me, there are two main differences. First, as you may guess, it's size. So, a very big, for example, a very, very big large cap PE fund in France, it would be 6 billion. A fund in US, for example, a Blackstone fund, is 25. So first question of size. Also something important, because we all know the names, you know, Blackstone, KKR, Apollo, Carlyle, and so on. But in fact, the private equity industry, it's a long tail industry. What does it mean? It means that you have a very few big actors and a huge number of very small funds. So basically, do not imagine that working in a PE fund is similar, you know, in large cap and small cap, totally different. Okay? So size of the fund, size of the firms also, because obviously, let me tell you something. In France, a 50 million euro EBITDA business is already a big small business. In US, it's peanuts, you know, clearly. So this is the first stuff. Second, I have to say, this is the financing and the aggressivity of the BP. So in US, they use more leverage than in France. For example, in France, I have to say, it's very, very common to have a buyout, half equity, half debt. In USA, it's more 70% debt, 30% equity. So basically, the leverage is much higher. And much higher, why? First, because the banks in USA, they can lend more than in Europe due to regulatory constraints and so on. And also, they put more infinite debt. So I don't know if you know what is infinite debt. This is a debt which is paid at the end, in fact. And so basically, when you are a PE fund manager, your job is to sell the business before the maturity of the debt. And so this is the proceeds of the selling that pay back the debt, you know. Okay? But since the leverage is bigger, but the BP has to be like that. If you have a flat BP, obviously you will fail. Okay? So I have to say, obviously in USA, they use more leverage, so they have a higher internal rate of return compared to France, but also with a higher risk. So the risk of bankruptcy and so on is higher than in France, for example.
Okay, super. And we also wanted to ask you a question on the compensation, since it can be hard to find some reliable information. You know, some firms require their associates or vice president, managing director, and other GPs to invest what we call a carried interest into the investment made. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, but basically, in fact, a PE fund, it's like a partnership, in fact. So basically, what does it mean? It means that the carried, this is the money you put in the fund, and as a reward, you have access to the profit of the investment, you know, basically. So something which is very important, as you said in question, the carried, the biggest part is for the GPs, you know, so the partners. If you go as an analyst and you ask for a carried, good luck. And by the way, you have some small funds giving carried even to junior analysts. Mm-hmm. In order to attract junior analysts, otherwise you are a small fund, good luck to attract people, you know. Okay? But you work in a large cap fund and you ask a carried as an analyst, yeah, good luck. Huh? So, basically, you put some money. Okay? And long story short, in fact, all the partners of the fund, they put in average between 1 to 5% of the fund size. So you can say to yourself, yeah, 1 to 5%, yeah, it's not so much. Yeah, 1%, for example, of a 20 billion fund, do the computation, you know. So basically, you have already to have a lot of money, you know, in order to invest for the carried. And second stuff, so this is, you have to say, the skin in the game, as they say. The second stuff is that, in fact, you have what is called a waterfall in a PE fund, which is, in fact, a share of profit between LPs, so the your investors, in fact, and GPs, so you, the carried. And so basically, the basic rule, that you have a preferred return to your investors, so 8%, and everything above this preferred return, 20% is for you. And so believe me, it can be a huge amount of money. But something very important to keep in mind. In order to earn 100% of the carry, you have to stay the full lifetime of the fund, so 10 years. And so it can be very long. And 10 years, there is no extension. Because with extension and continuation fund, it can go up to 13 years in order to earn your carry. So clearly, this is a very long-term investment, in fact. Definitely not short-term, carried. Okay?
Mm-hmm. And what would have happened if you don't have the capital? Or, like, are you required to take, like, a loan? Or is it taken straight out of your paycheck or bonus?
Basically, But basically, you can take some private loan. So you have a lot of private banks which can give you a loan to that. But again, beware, because it's risky. Yeah? Because there is no guarantee that you earn a carry. Yeah? I know a lot of PE fund whose carry is that. Huh? Yeah. So something important. The 15% internal rate of return, this is an average. So you have people above, you have people below, you know. And so clearly, if you are below, you say goodbye to your money, in fact. And so if you take a loan, you say goodbye to your house also, for example. Okay? That's why most of the time, people working in private equity, they come from investment banking. Because since in M&A and so on, you already make a lot of money, at least you have some money to invest, you know? Okay?
Before wrapping up your discussion on markets, we'd like to know what trends and practice areas are you most excited for, looking forward to 2024 and beyond?
That's a hard question, I have to say. Basically, in my opinion, this year, it will be a very good year if you start LBO, in fact. And why? Because as I said, a lot of sellers were in pause mode the last 2 years, expecting the market to warming up, you know. And now, since you have small signals that it is warming up, you will have a kind of selling wave. And selling wave is good, because the real problem is that if everyone sells at the same time, the price will be lower, in fact. The price will be lower because you will say, hey, why should I buy your business, Matisse, while I can buy the business of Rubik, you know? Mm-hmm. Okay? So in my opinion, this year it will be a very good vintage, I think. So that's about LBOs. In my opinion, a segment which is pretty difficult for the last 4 years, I have to say, it's venture capital. The financing of startup really in France, it collapsed. And why? Because honestly, there was a kind of bubble, in fact. So, and when I say bubble, for example, I knew a French firm which was a unicorn, so valuation above 1 billion. The annual recurring revenue was 30 million. So basically, to have a valuation of 1 billion when you have an IRR of 30 million, it's a nonsense. I have seen startups valued at 150 times sales. So basically, it's nonsense. And so obviously, the fund which invested in those firms, those are crying, you know, because they have to mark down their investment. And I have seen some 80% discount. Okay. So just to not throw the baby with the water, with the bath, you know, clearly, there is still some fundraising, but the condition are much more strict than before. So now, in order to get funding, you should really have a good business. And what does it mean? It means that already some sales, and you should be able to demonstrate break-even, EBITDA break-even in 2 years. Okay? And so it was very funny because during COVID, you had a lot of VCs saying growth, growth, growth. And now they said return, return, return. So basically, yeah, EBITDA is important, in fact. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
The last trend, just one last trend.
Go ahead. Yeah, important.
Sure. The problem nowadays is you don't want to sell the business in at a lower valuation than the one you have bought it, you know, in a buyout. If you bought it at 10 times EBITDA, you don't want to sell it at 9 times EBITDA, okay? Otherwise, not multiple expansion, it's multiple compression, you know? And so something which used to be very popular last year, and I think it's still the case this year, is what is called GP-led secondaries, continuation fund. So what it is, imagine Mathis and Rick, you have a PE firm. You have a PE fund, for example, McGill One, and you have a lot of good businesses in it, but you don't want to sell them at the discount. And so, in fact, you will create another PE fund called McGill Two, for example, and so McGill One will sell the business to McGill Two. So the real question is about selling, okay, but at which price? Because they're just a question of conflict of interest, you know, between the different investors. But by the way, this is very, very popular. Very popular.
Well, we heard.
Just to keep the firms longer, you know.
So basically, you're saying the same firm would raise another fund and with the second fund would buy the same company as the same fund.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Well, moving on to the mentorship and guided segments, are there any specific skills or experiences that are particularly valuable in the private equity space?
Yeah. So basically, I will tell you exactly what I tell to my students. Okay, exactly the same stuff. For me, for example, being good in finance and I would say in private equity, it's not a skill, it's a prerequisite, you know? So, I mean, if you are not good in finance, you won't work in private equity, point. So basically, it's not on this stuff that you can distinguish yourself, in fact. Okay? So obviously, you should be good at financial modeling, at valuation, at financial analysis, and so on. Okay. But for me, if you want to work in private equity, I have to say, let's focus on three skills. First, understanding businesses. So, and here, basically, we're talking about marketing, strategy, organization, and so on. So understanding businesses, because a BP otherwise is just numbers, you know. You can put what you want as number, you know, in the BP. It's because you have a good understanding of the underlying company, of its strategy, its organization, its environment, that you can judge if the numbers are real, you know. Okay. And here, this is a hard skill to grasp, you know. The second skill for me, it's rigor and time management. Same in M&A. Why? Because in fact, you will work under very limited time frames and big pressure, especially if you work in large cap. And so you have to be reliable and organized. What does it mean? Nothing is worse than an analyst giving some work to a senior associate and a VP, and at the end, they have to redo it, you know, because the quality is not good. So clearly, it's for me, time management, it's a very, very important skill in finance. Very important skill. And I have to say, the last skill, especially when you will climb the ladder, but it's in fact soft skills, because PE is a people business, in fact. You will have to negotiate with investment banker. You have to discuss strategy and negotiate with CEOs. So in fact, the human interaction is very, very important. Very, very important. And so that's why most of the time, engineers, they suck at it, you know? So, you know, compared to business schools, you know? But it's really, really important. Communication, negotiation, and basically also leadership, you know? So how to motivate people, you know? Because sometimes working in a PE fund is not fun, you know?
Yeah. And how do you think students should go about finding an internship in private equity?
So to answer to this question, let me tell you a good news and then a bad news. So we start with the good one. The good one is that now it's possible to start an internship in PE. At my times, impossible. At my times, first, you made 3 to 5 years in M&A, and then you went to PE. When I say PE, it's buyout. So VC is totally different, okay? But we focus on buyout. And so basically, I have to say, this is the very common way. You start in an IB, 2, 3, maximum 5 years. For example, when you are an associate, most of the time to transition to PE is very easy. But nowadays, and I say it started really maybe, 6 to 7 years ago maybe, large cap in the PE industry, they also started to recruit junior analysts. So for example, you can apply to Blackstone without working in an IB. But believe me, an internship in M&A is mandatory before. Eh? So you won't be able to apply without an internship in M&A, clearly. And let me tell you something, it's very, very competitive, much more than for an internship in M&A. Eh? For example, Blackstone London, by memory, they recruit 3 to 4 analysts per year. Okay? For the whole Europe. Eh? So clearly, yeah. Very, very competitive. So my advice, it starts doing 1 or even 2 internships in tier one M&A firms. So obviously, one internship, I have to say, in Goldman and the other internship in Rothschild is better than 2 internships in a small M&A boutique, you know. But in finance, branding on the CV is very important. Very, very important. And why? Because it's a kind of selection process. So for example, the PE fund, they know that the selection process is very hard at Goldman and Rothschild. And so basically, if you have made internship there, it's already a filter, you know?
All right. So for the last question in the mentorship segment, what would be your number one advice for someone looking to raise a first private equity fund?
Alors, here it's really good luck. here it's really good luck. And why? Because in fact, something which is very important for limited partners is track record. So track record is past deals. And so basically, if you are a first-time manager, then by definition, you have no track record. So here, it would be very difficult. And so basically, most of the time, people launching their first PE fund, it's simply because they leave another PE fund, in fact. So basically, you are an MD in a large cap PE fund or something like that. You want to be independent. You will try to launch your own fund. But it's not easy for two reasons. Because imagine that you are from a very prestigious PE fund. Let's say, for example, KKR, to change from Blackstone. The real problem is that, first, the brand. If you launch your own PE fund, you are not under the KKR brand, you know? So basically, it would be hard to impose your own brand. And the second point, that KKR, they have a huge infrastructure. So clearly, for one deal guy, you have four non-deals people, you know, in order to manage all the processes, you know. Here, you don't have this kind of infrastructure, you know. And so basically, you will have to raise a much smaller fund. And so basically, you will have to hire people who are able to multitask, in fact. Because, you know, 2% of management fees, 2% of management fees, when you have a 1 billion fund, yeah, it's big. But when you have a 100 million fund, it's not so much. Clearly, yeah. So the life is tough, believe me.
Back to what you said about needing that track record. I mean, it's exactly what happened to Blackstone with Stefan Schwarzman that was working at Lehman Brothers as an MD before. So it's definitely
you know the founder of KKR, I think they were from Bear Stearns, if I remember well. So mm-hmm. Obviously, you have to go through investment banking.
Yeah.
And why? Because your job is to make deals. Your job is to buy business. Then you have a lot of build-ups. So that means that those business will make also some add-on acquisition. And then to sell business. So basically, if you work in PE, long story short, 2/3 of your time will be about M&A, in fact. Huh? So that's why.
And now moving on to the rapid fire questions. What is the best piece of advice that anyone's ever given you?
So for me, the best piece of advice is clearly, you know, at HEC Paris, we have a kind of motto, you know, which is learn to dare, à apprendre à oser. And for example, I dared to write to Peter Carr at Morgan Stanley 20 years ago, while in fact he was a top quant, and I was basically no one. So long story short, obviously I wrote to a lot of quants. As you may guess, most of the answers were no. But at least one answered yes. Okay? And so, same for teaching. One professor at HEC, it was really, really busy because, in fact, it was the head of M&A at Société Générale. And so, he had to teach some corporate finance classes, but it was very, very busy. And so I asked to him, yeah, but if you want, I can teach at your place. And he said, yeah, okay. So congrats, you are my teaching assistant, you know. And it was done in 5 minutes, basically. And so that's how I started teaching, in fact. If I haven't dared those moves, I won't be here, honestly. So, you know, this is what I say to my students, avoid auto-censorship. So, you know, I have some students who say, oh, you know, I won't apply to Goldman because sure, I won't be taken. I say, hey, who knows? Who knows? You try, you do your best, and then we'll see. When I applied to MBA finance at HEC, I had no financial background. I applied also in strategy consulting at USCP because as a backup, because I expected to not be taken, in fact. And finally, I was taken. So, you know, there, no more, no less.
So taking chances. And on a scale of 1 to 10, how important would you say your GPA is as a student?
Yeah, honestly, it's not important. And why? Because in fact, all the people are playing in investment banking, they will have top grades. So here is the same. What distinguishes you from other, you know? So, I remember that just to finish this answer. I have some guy who say, "Hey, you know, I come from Ecole Polytechnique." Yeah, and you know, in my class, there are 50. So you have 49 competitors. So what distinguishes you from others? Okay, the GPA is not enough, because when you apply tier one investment banking or to tier one strategy consulting, for example, the MBB, you know, obviously you have already very high GPA, because again, it's a kind of prerequisite, in fact. So again, remember in strategy, what is important is differentiation. What are your strengths and why are you different from the others, you know?
If you wouldn't be in the financial industry, what would you be doing instead?
This is a good question, you know. So, honestly, I think that if research was paid like in M&A, honestly, I think I would still be a physicist. Honestly. And why? Simply for the intellectual challenge. Because, long story short, in M&A, when you are in front of your PPT, your investment memo, doing a BP on Excel, we are not talking about nuclear physics, you know? So, and so, by the way, this is important. I have some students who quit M&A because they got bored. No more, no less, in fact. Because intellectually, it's not very challenging, in fact. You don't have a fancy financial models. You don't have fancy intellectual stuff and so on. But something I like in this job is the diversity, because each deal is totally different. Even if it's the same sector, each deal is totally different because the firm is different, the top management is different, the investment banker in charge of the deal are different, and so on. So in fact, it doesn't repeat. The models repeat, but the human interaction each time is different, in fact.
And lastly, Benjamin, what is one book you would recommend to our listeners?
So for me, there is very one good book. And by the way, I know the author of these books. One is global head of M&A at the Royal Bank of Canada in New York. So it's Investment Banking by Joshua Pearl and Joshua Rosenbaum. I'm sure that you already know this book, in fact.
Yeah, we read it.
Yeah. Because for me, again, this book, it's a prerequisite, in fact. If you haven't read this book, good luck to work in a tier one IB. About private equity, for me, one I like very much, it's Mastering Private Equity by Claudia Zeisberger. So she is a professor at INSEAD, so a very big business school also. And she she worked in PE for more than 15 years now, I think. So clearly, this book is a good introduction. And if you want to have a critical view of private equity, I can advise you the best book criticizing private equity, which is Private Equity Laid Bare by Ludovic Falipou from Oxford. So the Oxford State Business School. And honestly, very nice book also.
All right. Well, thank you, Benjamin, for being so generous with your time.
Oh, no, my pleasure.
The sole purpose of this podcast is to educate and to inform our listeners. It is by no means a substitute for professional guidance by qualified experts. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute financial or other professional advice or services. Instead, we encourage you to discuss your career options, as well as financial undertakings with other professionals who specialize in wealth, securities, and asset management, or any other field in financial services. The information, opinions, and recommendations presented in this podcast are for general information only, and any reliance on the information provided in this podcast is done at a personal and individual risk. This podcast should not be considered professional advice. Guests who speak on this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. The views expressed on this platform are personal opinions and only, and should not be construed as financial advice for your given situation or from a given institution. While all attempts are made to present accurate information, it may not be appropriate for specific circumstances, and information may become outdated over time. No firm, nor any company providing financial support endorses or opposes any particular view or tools discussed in this podcast. This podcast is available for private, non-commercial use only. Advertising, which is incorporated into, placed in association with, or targeted towards the content of this podcast is forbidden. This podcast may not be edited, modified, or redistributed. The Corporate Chat Podcast has no liability for any personal activities in connection with this podcast or for personal use of this podcast in connection with personal websites, computers, or playing devices. Moreover, the Corporate Chat Podcast makes no warranty that this podcast or the server that makes it available is free of viruses, worms, or other elements or codes that manifest contaminating or destructive properties. McGill University and our sponsors expressly disclaims any and all liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, incidental, special, consequential, or other damages arising out of any individual's use of, reference to, reliance on, or inability to use this podcast or the information presented in this podcast.